Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, news personality Antoine Sanfuentes. He's the vice president and managing editor for the Washington Bureau of CNN. Previously, he was vice president of NBC News, where he also oversaw the production of Meet the Press. In addition to his long and distinguished career in the news business, he's a passionate photographer of musicians the world over, not to mention a great music lover. In a time as starkly and viciously divided as ours, where does this stalwart of the so-called mainstream media see his business fitting in? Does objective truth exist? And do Americans even care one way or another? Well, Antoine Sanfuentes is here to offer his opinions on these questions and much more. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
How does someone get into the news business? You wake up as a 5-year-old and you see the newspaper lying around. You say, I want to do that. What happens? Where's the passion come from?
Well, actually, you're not far off. I was a paper delivery guy as a young man. I delivered the Advertiser in Maryland, where I live in Montgomery County. But really, it was ultimately, I was in college. I was doing college radio, exposed to news growing up, of course. CBS Evening News, Walter Cronkite, foreign affairs, domestic affairs. We talked about all of that. Post watching the show at the dinner table. But ultimately, it was an internship at the WRC-TV NBC News building just down the street from American University, where I went to school. The internship involved the press and publicity department. I gave tours of the building. I connected with the history of broadcasting and news. And when the internship completed, it coincided with my graduation with an anthropology degree. And I was given the opportunity to either work in the sales department or the newsroom. And of course, I chose the newsroom with an entry-level job.
Okay, entry-level job, got it. You're not at an entry-level job anymore. We can get there, talk about what happened in the middle. What does anthropology have to do with the news? It strikes me that perhaps more than one might think.
Well, it's all of it, really. It's the study of people, the study of man, as they put it originally, but I see it as the study of culture, demographics, how we live, where we're going, how we speak, all of it. I think the connection, while my professors scratched their heads initially about my requesting the internship, it actually made I made a perfect transition. And frankly, what we do on the inside is to serve our audience on the outside. And I think with my approach, my background in anthropology, my training as a journalist in TV news, the combination actually made a lot of sense. Still does.
Does studying anthropology make one a more sensitive person? I imagine, obviously, I mean, the answer has to be yes. So you're studying demographics, you're studying cultures, then you're in a situation of numbers and metrics and a very different world, right?
Yeah, but ultimately it's about storytelling and asking lots of questions and anticipating what your audience might be feeling or wondering or the questions that they may have, channeling all of that from your vantage point on the inside. We often say that our newsroom really should reflect the audience in terms of that we serve.
Talk about how you think news is presented now versus a long time ago. Say, well, not, let's give it 30 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, pre-internet. Do you think people were right then to trust the news as a whole more than they do now? And are they wrong now to trust the news less, or are they right? Clearly, the quote, media is having a rough time. What's supposed to be done?
I will disagree with you in part. In terms of trust, it frankly comes down to who do you trust and who do you listen to? And of course, we're all different as human beings. And that, again, falls into my anthropological thinking. We all have our internal biases. We work through them. Of course, as journalists, we strive for the impartiality. Of course, the audience may disagree with that at times. We try to get it right. That's really our mandate. And we have checks and balances, of course, in terms of how we do the work that we do. The traditional news that you speak of, say, when I was growing up watching Walter Cronkite, you know, there was a formula in terms of perhaps starting overseas or starting at the White House tonight. I think the audience today is a bit more fragmented. You know, the world is so much bigger and smaller at the same time because of the advent of the internet. It is also available in bite-sized pieces. People consume their news today vastly differently than they did many years ago. But fundamentally, I think if whatever you happen to be interested in, there is a news outlet, there is a news story that will attract you. So if anything, I think the field is much larger. It is much more competitive. It is much more live and in real time. And I think the pressure continues on journalistic organizations to maintain those checks and balances, to get the stories right. You know, our journalism here at CNN, I'm sure you're familiar with our campaigns in the past, the fact base, getting the facts right, that, you know, at the core of what we do every single day is so important.
You know, I'm a millennial. I wasn't around in the age when there were three network news and you sat down, you had one. I mean, I did, you know, grow up watching evening news with Dan Rather. Okay, but by that point, there were already lots of options in the 90s. But you don't think that 40, 50 years ago, there was a greater acceptance among the American populace who are watching the news that what they saw on the news was true compared to now? It sounds like you don't think that.
Well, I think the world has changed. I think our sources of information have increased vastly. We have an opportunity versus watching the CBS News and getting a sense of what happened in the world because of their advantage on scale. We now have open source pipelines to track the news. We can drill down going to the local paper, local radio, local television. The vast majority of the content is available online. You can almost call your own newscast. You can do your own research. You can agree or disagree with how a particular story has been edited. If anything, we live in good times as far as access to information. But then, you know, I think what you're getting at is in terms of going to sources that you trust. And at the very, very basics of it, there is the traditional journalism in terms of how we do what we do, how we're trained to do what we do. And again, that is fact-based reporting versus something that is not true that is being reported.
When did it become clear to you? You've been in the business for a couple decades or more. When did it become clear to you, Antoine Sanfuentes, that the truth is elusive? It's there. It can be hard to find, but at a certain point, it is what resonates with people, or at least some people. When did that word become a golden emblem?
I find that the chart of our mission has never changed. It's the headwinds that we deal in terms of propagandists who are out there co-opting the news to try to bend it to the message that they're trying to put out. I think you know, in terms of having covered the Trump White House, it's no different, I think, in part, I should say, to the spin that we've seen coming out of other White Houses. Of course, this particular White House accelerated and put out just abject falsehoods consistently when you would expect more from the highest office in the land as far as the American government goes. But I think, you know, our mission as journalists has never changed. It's the headwinds that I speak of in terms of the access. The town square that was such that was available to those who lived there in the periphery of it. Now the town square, that one person with a megaphone has access to the vast resources of the internet and can get it out there. We're also learning lots and lots about misinformation, how foreign governments can promote misinformation, can entangle themselves in U.S. elections and promote falsehoods, getting certain issues stirred up over information that frankly is not true. And that, if anything, makes our mission every single day even more important in terms of the fact-based, the debunking of what has just happened here and what has been said.
I'd like to drill down. I don't like that phrase, but I'm going to use it. I'd like to drill down on what you just said, because it's very interesting when you talk about foreign government. So let's say you have a foreign government that is maybe not the best friend in the world of the United States. Okay, not Russia, but take a place like Hungary, perhaps, who's under Viktor Orban, obviously growing towards an authoritative direction and posing a greater and greater threat to its membership in the EU, and not accepting general EU democratic doctrine. What do you do if you have a story out of Hungary or a story put out by the government? Do you say we have to look at this more closely before we report it? Do you have to do harder research into it than if it was something coming out of Germany, coming out of France?
I think our checks and balances are the same, whether it is an ally of the United States or Hungary, where the information can be suspect. You know, I think this line about trust but verify, I think, is absolutely important. And this is why we fact check stories, reporting, releases coming from foreign governments. We have to. I mean, it's really part of what we do. And if anything, that process has been accelerated because of our news timeline, our challenges, our deadlines. We're constantly updating our audience through the internet, through social media, and on television. It's really, they're all in sync, and our audience consumes it voraciously. But before we can put it out there, we do have to check it out.
The 24-hour news cycle, it seems like it's a lot sort of more intense by the year, not to mention the website of CNN, which obviously has to be sort of updated, you know, a million times a second. What is a challenge there? Obviously, when you went into the news business, it was challenging in itself. It was not easy pre-internet. How is it all balanced out? How is it the need for speed balanced with the need for accuracy, balanced with the goals for some elegance in the prose even?
Yeah, well, I mean, CNN has the advantage of scale. We have 4,000 people who work at CNN, and it's comprised at every level from reporters, producers, editors, writers, the technical staff. As your audience grows, your reach grows, so do your mechanisms, your editorial mechanisms, your checks and balances, all of it, so that there's a pass through. Think of it as a funnel, if you want to use that example, so that hopefully at the end of the day, we get it right. And look, if we don't, we do have the advantage that we are 24/7, and we do have the advantage of adding updates to our reported pieces, and we will go online and correct or update our stories as we see fit.
I want to go back to anthropology for a second. Are there times that you can look back on during your studies of anthropology where you learned something or studied something or gleaned some information about a culture that influenced the way you approached covering the news and your ethical approach to covering the news?
That's a very interesting question you pose. So I studied anthropology, just, you know, the book part, the armchair part, pretty in depth. I took a few archaeological field schools, which took me into the field. One was here locally in Virginia that took me back to the Ice Age. But let me reflect on a different experience, and that was the Chinchorro down in South America. It was a Chilean coast, a very dry desert there, the Atacama Desert. Just shy of the Peruvian border. And I was there with Dr. Marvin Allison, renowned for his studies of paleo diseases. And we spent the summer, a few weeks during the summer, pulling mummified remains out of the desert facing the ocean. These were hunter-gatherer types who had, upon death, been mummified and positioned in such a way, it was believed, where they were actually standing up on posts to overlook the villages, to provide support, guidance, kind of this kind of almost theological presence. And it was just an incredible experience. It was thought-provoking. And it's just a reminder to me, as we go forward, we come from somewhere. We have a deep, rich history. And in terms of understanding people, in terms of moving into the future, you have to understand the past. And I think that that is key thinking on my part. And really, to the job every day, I bring cultural sensitivity. That's what I think about. How will this story go over? What will people think about this? Is this controversial? Have we thought about all sides of the issue to factor in this story? Is it fair beyond the fact that it's accurate, right? What are the motives of the sources as we speak to them for this particular story to get out? So all of that plays, but really, you know, drawing from my anthropological experiences, I think it's awfully important to approach the job and the reporting and what we do, frankly, with respect. I think that's really it. You know, respecting the role of journalism, respecting the audience who is consuming the journalism, and again, it's drawing from the history, because that's important too. We have a role in terms of upholding the First Amendment every single day, and we fought long and hard to protect and uphold this democracy to get to where we are today.
You mentioned a phrase I liked a lot: cultural sensitivity. As someone who's been sort of in the broad world of culture my whole life, you know, in classical music, I've had a front row seat to the incredible human progress that can happen when you are immersed in other cultures. I've been traveling all over the world as long as I can remember, playing concerts, and whether it's in China or Oman or Australia or Mississippi or Chicago or anywhere in between, you know, you could really find this sort of common ground around music and around other cultural things, maybe food and a few other things. And I do feel if more Americans, I can only speak for Americans because I happen to live here and be American, if more Americans had a broader awareness, a broader cultural sensitivity, perhaps there would be less coarseness and brittleness in the national discourse, which is pretty low at points.
Mm-hmm. And look, I remember Barack Obama, who traveled back to his state house to speak, and he talked about civil discourse and how ideologically divided our country had become at the time. And I remember him invoking, I think, the time of Lincoln. And I have to go back and reread his speech, but it was really a thoughtful story about how divided our country had been at times during its history, and how we had seen what we see today before. We've seen this before, he said, and we will get through this, because after all, we are all Americans. We come from diverse backgrounds. We understand what it means to live here in America and what we fought so long and hard to uphold.
Continuing on the cultural front, I know you yourself balance your work in the news business with other work, photography, a passion for music. How does that all play in? When did you pick up a camera? I guess you didn't have one with you when you were dropping off newspapers in Maryland.
Not that early, but my father had camera, a beautiful Pen-F camera, half-frame camera with all the lenses. And I wasn't quite worthy of those cameras. He's no longer with us, but I do have his cameras now. And at one point, he did entrust me to pick them up and allow me to shoot. And I thought my father had a terrific eye. But I picked up the cameras while covering the White House. And that was really the first beginning. As I produced stories, large and small, covering the White House, starting really under Bill Clinton, I watched with just bewilderment the White House photographers as they followed the president and captured his every move. And I bought a Leica M6 film camera. It was my paycheck, my first, you know, paycheck large enough to allow me to purchase such a camera. And it's how I first got into taking pictures, political pictures. I essentially started taking photographs of the American White House press corps taking pictures of the president and the presidency. So I was less focused on doing what they were doing. I was more focused on being behind the scenes and taking images of the White House press corps taking pictures of the president of the United States. And I greatly enjoyed that. So I that allowed me to upgrade cameras along the way. And I started doing more and more of that. And then my political photography morphed into music photography because I, not unlike you, I'm not a, I don't consider myself a professional drummer, but I have played professionally and recorded professionally. And I ended up using my photography as an entree into the music world. And I've been taking pictures of musicians now, mostly musicians. Once I left, you know, the day-to-day coverage of the White House and went into more of a supervisory role, I started taking pictures of musicians, large and small. Most recently, I was lucky enough to be one of a few photographers allowed to capture the Rolling Stones at their concert in Pittsburgh.
How was the concert?
Incredible. I mean, I think the Rolling Stones, we miss Charlie Watts. He has been one of the greatest influence on American drummers and drummers around the world as far as rock and roll. But of course, he was also a great jazz drummer. And at his core, he never stopped being a jazz drummer. So he brought all of that wonderful approach. And of course, Steve Jordan, who I considered a whom I consider to be a friend. You know, we've often talked about the virtues and the incredible legacy that Charlie Watts has left behind, of course, through his music, because that is ultimately how your legacy is formed, the music that you leave behind and how you perform it for the audience to enjoy. But that concert was so incredible. The humility and the remembrance of Charlie, the music was so appropriate. Charlie just would have been proud. And of course, Charlie recognizing he may not be up to this tour, asked for Steve Jordan to step in and fill the drum seat. And of course, his untimely passing, which no one expected, meant that Steve, in his honor, would continue on with the tour as he is doing now. And the reviews have just been wonderful. And it's so great to be reading about how wonderful the Stones music is being received now as they're approaching 80, right? I mean, they're in their late 70s. Steve in his mid to late 60s, the young guy. But all of it's, you know, wonderful for me. I'm a rock and roll fan, and I think the Rolling Stones is one of the greatest rock and roll bands.
Since we got to music, sort of, what other music do you like? I mean, other than the Rolling Stones, what could we find you listening to? Should we, you know, sort of teleport into your dining room or something, or wherever you listen to music?
Well, I like all forms of music. I was, you name it, I like it. If it's if it's got a good rhythm, I like it even more. I've listened to all kinds of music. Of course, rock and roll. I grew up on that. I love jazz. I like 60s era jazz. I've played some of it. I've also worked as an advocate and helped jazz musicians in need. We can certainly get into one in particular that I'm passionate about. Soul music. I've done some work with Stax and the Soulsville Foundation in Memphis. I have shot sessions in studios, including Boz Scaggs at Royal in Memphis. John Mayer, I've shot his concerts, also shot him in the studio at Electric Lady in New York. So my musical tastes are quite diverse. And beyond my ears, of course, there's my eye and my camera, and I'm always looking for the next best shoot. I'm actually looking to do more of that if I can, when I can, when I have the time.
You mentioned something before. We can come back to music, but before we get too far off that, you mentioned taking pictures of the White House press corps as they take photos of the president of the United States. Where did that come from, and where does the obsession, and maybe it's a silly question, but where does the obsession to take constant pictures of the president come from? I don't know how many pictures are taken of the president every day. It would be an interesting number to find, but it must be
thousands. Lots. I mean, thousands, probably. If you were to compute how many images one camera is actually taking because of these automatic cameras. They press the shutter and they're taking, you know, 10, 20, 30 pictures in the span of just a few seconds. So lots of images by the White House press corps are being captured of the president so long as the event is public and the cameras are allowed to cover the event. That's not always the case. But my interest as an observer, frankly, as the resident anthropologist, I was mainly interested in watching what's happening here. And I wanted to document something that, frankly, most people don't get to see. It's such a privilege to cover the White House, to be inside White House grounds, to have covered the presidency domestically around the country, but also overseas for some major events. And frankly, to document what a member of the press corps might see versus the events that the audience would actually see, you know, while reading their paper or reading a story online or seeing the story on television. I like to show you what's happening behind the scenes. That's been my interest.
Yeah, I like the use of the word anthropological again. So you're sitting there and you say to yourself, wait a minute, this is an interesting phenomenon that's happening. I need to take photos of this. Is it like that?
Absolutely. Like, for example, Bill Clinton, he liked to enjoy the outdoors when he would take his presidential vacations during the waning days of the summer. So he went out to Jackson Hole. He did it several years by traveling out to Wyoming. I remember one trip in particular. They announced he was going to go on a boat ride on one of the beautiful lakes there, not too far outside of Jackson. And I remember traveling to the just to the shore to do what we call a stakeout. We'd often go with a camera and just find a place to just take some video of the president enjoying the outdoors. Well, he was on a boat, and there was a separate boat full of the press corps there to shoot the so-called photo ops, so the video camera and the still cameras. And so I had my still camera with my long lens, and I was there on the shore of the lake, and I captured the scene. So if you can just envision the image, it's a shot of the president kind of sitting back with his cap on, and there's an adjacent boat just full of cameras almost falling over, taking a shot of the president relaxing in his boat, right? And my frame shows the two boats in the middle of this beautiful blue lake.
it sounds like a great image. I'm picturing it now. It sounds terrific, and that's the kind of thing that probably a lot of people don't think about is happening because we see the one boat.
That's right.
But it's like
you see the documentary about the mountain climber who's gone up Everest, right? And you see all the dramatic images fighting the ice falls and climbing up the wall and all. Well, somebody's got to be taking a picture of that, right? So imagine the third person taking a picture of the guy taking a picture of the rock climber. That's me.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. You mentioned a jazz musician earlier. Who are we talking about? Why is this person special?
Well, this person is special. His name was Edward Butch Warren. I called him Butch, of course, and the musicians called him Butch. He was the sideman, one of the principal sidemen at Blue Note in the early 60s, along with Herbie Hancock, Billy Higgins. He can be heard on probably what would be his most famous contribution, Watermelon Man, which, of course, was on Herbie Hancock's breakthrough record on Blue Note called Taken Off. And Butch went on to power a lot of these key records in the early 60s on Blue Note. And I met him, of course, many, many years later in 2007, after reading a story about him in the local paper about how he had been languishing in a mental hospital, and the attendants there discovered after Googling his name, he had made reference to his past as a jazz musician. That not only was he a jazz musician, but he was an incredibly famous jazz musician. And so I set about on my search after reading the story, thinking, well, maybe is he still in the hospital? Did he get out or what? So I called some of the musicians who were mentioned in the article, and they said, oh, yeah, he's out. And he plays at this jam session every Wednesday night, I think it was, down in the area of Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C. So I grabbed my camera I went to seek him out, and that began a relationship of sorts, even advocate. And I took his pictures for many more years as he struggled to make his way through life, which was hard for a man with mental with a mental disability, until he passed. He passed of cancer several years ago. But we managed to not only document his comeback of sorts, he recorded a full-length a recording with friends in the jazz community, a studio called Bias Recording in Falls Church. They loaned the studio and their time to help him record his own record day, which was ultimately his goal in life to do on his own. And he remembered some of these songs that had been swirling in his head, he said, for decades. He had written some songs that were performed by famous musicians like Sonny Clark and Dexter Gordon. But in this instance, these were songs that he wanted to perform on his own recording. And we managed to do that. And he also managed to travel to France and to perform to large audience there there as well. So he really made quite an extraordinary comeback before, unfortunately, we lost him to cancer.
Yeah, he died in 2013. I'm saying it's very moving that this little story here that the staff at the mental hospital had no clue who he was until
someone just
got curious, Googled him, and learned who he was. And apparently he'd been asking for permission to play the piano in the rec room there. So odd situation to picture, but very moving.
Indeed. Absolutely.
Why is it interesting to take pictures of musicians? Is it just because you like music?
I'm a drummer. So as a drummer, of course, bass players, and that's what led me to want to meet Butch and then ultimately help Butch. And of course, Butch's last major gig was with Thelonious Monk during one of the heights of Monk's comebacks in New York City. But yeah, as a drummer, of course, having performed on the bandstand and collaborated with musicians my whole life, it felt natural to use the camera and document that as best as I could.
Who do you have coming up? Can you talk? Can you say who you're going to photograph?
Well, maybe you will help me on that. But I coming fresh off having covered a Rolling Stones concert, I can tell you I'm still pinching myself because I think to get an opportunity to cover the Stones in concert is a pretty extraordinary thing. Of course, having covered and taken many pictures of Steve Jordan has been a thrill. You know, he describes me as his fly on the wall. And often he will have, a studio opportunity or something like that. And he'll call and I'll show with my cameras and the rest is obviously in the hard drive because a good part of it I've been collecting. At some point, we'll figure out what to do with it. And a good part of it goes on Steve's social media. And it's just for me, it's just a love affair. So we have fun with it.
Yeah, speaking of good drummers, and by the way, I can give you advice on who to photograph later on. Speaking of drummers, a good friend of mine owns a house in New Orleans. He's a violinist, my friend is. That was owned by one of the great old New Orleans drummers who played a lot with Louis Armstrong, named Paul Barbarin. And there's a big plaque on the house called the Barbarin House, Barbarin. And he was born in the 19th century, this guy. And there's videos of him playing online. He plays in this old style of New Orleans drumming when it was a very, very sort of a delicate style of drumming and a very beautiful, you can tell even from the old videos, a beautiful tone. And of course, with, timpani in the orchestra, we always think about tone. Not just is he playing in the right place, is the timpani tuned, but the quality of the sound. And with Paul Barbarin, there's something wonderful to it. He died during a Mardi Gras parade while playing the snare drum. So go figure.
Well, that's the way to go, right? I mean, if he was meant to play the drum and he passed doing what he loved. And of course, I think of Baby Dodds and Earl Palmer and all of these fantastic New Orleans drummers, Eddie Christmas. He plays these. I really enjoy his stuff. But the New Orleans style of playing is absolutely wonderful. It's fundamental, if you ask me, to the building blocks of American music. Of course, there's a little bit of that, you know, the Caribbean influence in terms of the old cruise ships back in the day. They would bounce back between the Caribbean and the Port of New Orleans. So the musical influence there is so extraordinary. You talk about the drum, the snare drum. You know, Steve Jordan will tell you, there are thousands of sounds that come from the snare drum based on how you play it. Of course, it's a musical instrument. You play the drum, you don't hit the drum, because hitting the drum and really describing playing drums as a physical exertion really minimizes the role that this instrument played. It's a musical instrument. You play it. And of course, the drummer back in the day, in terms of the traps, there were all kinds of essential elements that would be incorporated into the drummer's role in terms of making different sounds, the China cymbals, the China drums. Drummers were utilized not only for the orchestras, but silent films, circuses, you name it. I mean, the drummer has represented a very important musical role over time.
Absolutely. There's nothing better than when you're playing in an orchestra and the percussion section is really, really, really great. It makes you feel comfortable and happy. And then you never need to even check in with the conductor at all. No, that's a joke. Kidding. Antoine Cifuentes, I'm curious, as you look towards whatever is happening, and when Richard Haass was on with me recently, he made an interesting point. He said during the Cold War, he would wake up day after day and things would be basically the same. He'd know what was going on. He said he wakes up today, he has no clue what's going on in relation to yesterday or tomorrow. It's that different day to day as he looks at the state of the world. As you look at the state of the world, Antoine, I wonder what you see as some big challenges coming from the vantage of reporting, of covering, of convincing people, continuing to convince people that what you're doing is worthwhile. And yes, there is such a thing as objective reality.
Well, I take great pride that in terms of the work that I do and the team I do it with, I think there's a thirst for news and information. I think there's a challenge for relevance in terms of what information is consumed and by whom and on what platform. And I think, you know, here at CNN, of course, we've announced CNN Plus, which is the online version of what we do in terms of cable. But that thirst for news and information is very real. It's very necessary. Of course, we know in breaking news situations, what happened here. We know the audience will be there for us in terms of compelling news, reporting, what's going on, pulling the veil back with in American politics. All of that really, really matters because it comes down to accountability. Governments have accountability to the people that they serve. You know, in terms of news and information coming from the government, of course, that should always be taken with a grain of salt. How do you know? History speaks when it comes to that. So if anything, now more than ever, I feel more strongly about the mandate that journalists have. It's awfully important.
Yeah, you touched on something I liked. The great historian who just died recently, Marty Sherwin, you probably know the name, who wrote the great Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Oppenheimer. He came out with a new book just a year ago. And he was on this show last winter, and he said, how do historians know what we know? We know it because the government tells us. And he said it's deeply, deeply difficult to do it. You know, when you have 5 months out versus 50 years out from an event, the information that's released and the constant digging and searching for things that you may imagine to be real but have no proof.
Well, again, I mean, you know, the fact-based reporting, and that's why it's important, right? Trust but verify. I think, you know, it's also important to educate your audience on sources and methods in terms of how to understand what they're reading and whether to trust it or not, or whether to get a second source of information. I think the reader engagement now, you know, you have a choice. You can make that choice depending on what you want to read and what you want to believe. But I think that's a good thing. You know, you can start your day, you can read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, your local papers, local websites, Politico. All of it is available to you. So I think if anything, it's to encourage the consumer of news to broaden out, really trust your news sources, but also broaden out, read different perspectives. I think it's important.
Your title is the Vice President and Managing Editor for CNN's Washington Bureau. What does that mean? What does that entail exactly?
Well, so I oversee the White House, Capitol Hill, and politics news gathering. So I work with the reporters on the respective teams. We stay on top of the news. We deal with the reporting. We cover the stories in the field, which ultimately you will see on CNN cable, but also on CNN at CNN.com. And that's really my mandate. It's to deal with the to break news, reporting that is enterprise and original and new, keep government accountable, which would be the White House and our politicians on Capitol Hill, and stay current, relevant, inform the audience, all of it.
Do you still go into the White House yourself?
I do at times. Lately, not so much because of the pandemic. We were limited in terms of access, limited to the reporters that covered it every single day. We also tried to limit our numbers because of potential exposure. We are still, like every place in America, place of work in America, we are, we're all vaccinated here. We're in the office. We've had our teams flowing back in. But as far as covering the White House and Capitol Hill, our teams never left. They've been there the entire time.
What do you want to do in terms of photography, in terms of next steps? Okay, at CNN, you have a plum position. That's wonderful. The challenges never end. Or is there a personal challenge that you're looking towards?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to even think about what's happening next week. I think my challenges here are already pretty great. I do, at times look back on my career at CNN, but also NBC News, of course. I'm extremely grateful for all the opportunities, all of the history that I have witnessed. Of course, the picture taking that I've been able to do along the way, and at some point I should probably do something with it. But in terms of what happens next, honestly, I haven't had a lot of time to think about it.
Fair indeed. Let's take some final music recommendations from you, yeah? Final as in final of this conversation, not as a be-all, end-all of music.
I'm a retro guy. I like the Rolling Stones. I like the Beatles. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about the Beatles these days with the Peter Jackson documentary coming out. In terms of music that I, new music that I listen to, I honestly can't say that I listen to a lot of new music. I listen to new music from artists, I mentioned Boz Scaggs. I've liked everything that he has put out recently. But boy, you're stumping me. I listen to the hits, the old rock and roll hits, and soul music, of course. I love Stax music, Otis Redding, Booker T and the MGs. I mean, all the Carla Thomas, all the Stax music. I can't get enough of it. Of course, Al Jackson Jr., the drummer that powered so many hits there. But I'll have to get back to you on the new music. I'm still working my way through it. I'm working my way up to it, I should probably say.
Well, no problem. The classics are pretty good. That was a pretty good list right there. With music, photography, and an ear on the newsbeat, Antoine Sanfuentes, I indeed thank you. It's been a great pleasure of mine.
Daniel, it's my pleasure to connect with you, and thanks for making the time.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.